Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mary Roach, whose latest book is Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Earlier books, Stiff, Spook, and Bonk. And, of course, this one could have been called Void, Space, or Float.
I thought Brink, you know, the Brink, but my editor felt that that sounded like a book about prison. Four entire syllables. It was quite a shock to the system.
I'm curious how you get from one book to another. I mean, Stiff, which is about corpses, came out of a series of articles you were writing. Spook, which is an investigation of the possibility of life after death, how did that emerge?
That grew out of a chapter in Stiff. There was a chapter about how philosophers and anatomists used to take human bodies and actually look for the soul as a body part. Is it in the head? Is it maybe this strange little chunk here? Could that be the soul? So that was in Stiff, and then I was fascinated by that kind of intersection of science and religion and people trying to apply science to something like the human soul. So that blew out into Spook.
And then from Spook to Bonk?
There was a footnote. See, if you're a careful reader, if you can find the footnotes, if you're a careful reader, inside each book there's often a footnote that is a hint to the next book. There is a footnote about people having sex in an MRI machine and what had been learned. That was a footnote which then was kind of the germ of Bonk, the sex lab book.
So I would think that there must have been a little investigation into either weightless sex or sex in outer space.
You would think, but no, there was a footnote in, and I took it out because I wanted to use it in Packing for Mars, but there was a footnote, and don't ask me how I got off on this tangent, but there was a zero-gravity toilet footnote that I yanked so I could use it in the chapter in this book. So that was sort of where the clue was in this book.
And how did Packing for Mars then fully emerge from the research on the footnote, or was it just kind of an aside and you went back and took out the footnote?
It was an aside. I went back and took it out to use it. I got the idea talking to an acquaintance that works at the bed rest facility in Galveston, Texas, which is a very surreal place to visit. It's people lying in bed for 3 months at a time, lounging in their pajamas, surfing the net, being paid to do so because NASA is using them to study the effects of zero gravity. So you lie down in bed for 3 months without getting up. The same things happen to your body as would happen to an astronaut. It's a research facility that just looks like a bunch of slackers sitting around and, you know, playing video games. So I asked this guy, Renee, who works at the bed rest facility. I said, seriously, so there's this simulated weightlessness, and he was telling me other things that are simulated, because anything that happens in space, because space is such a hostile, foreign, strange, and expensive place to be, everything gets rehearsed here on Earth. You could essentially go into space without ever leaving Earth. And I was asking him, well, what other kinds of space on Earth situations are there? And I thought, well, that's a side to the space program that nobody's really familiar with, and it sounds kind of like the, you know, surreal and strange enough that I could wander around in it for a couple of years and do a book. So that conversation was where it began.
So how do you select the topics that you're going to cover in a book like Packing for Mars?
Very simply, it's me going, what is going to be most entertaining, fascinating, and surprising for people? Because you'll notice I tend to choose very, very broad topics. I'm not doing, you know, a specific history of the use of animals in space
right.
Or the space food program or something. I have to choose from all of space history and all of the sort of physiological side of it, the psychological stuff, all of which you could write two or three books about. So I've got this broad subject area, and then I can go and kind of cherry pick what I think is the most fascinating and fun to write about. I mean, I'm also being a little self-serving, and that's more fun for me to write about something if it's fun to research and write about. So I'm doing it for myself as well as for my readers. I'm trying to leave out the parts people skip.
You also make sure in your books that there's a little bit of hands-on as well.
Yes, I do try to do that. I am very much aware of the whole, you know, the tendency in nonfiction to do stunt literature, like I'm going to spend, you know, 6 months without using toilet paper, or I will recycle everything, or I will, you know, travel around the world without going on an airplane, whatever the quote-unquote stunt is. But I do find in some cases, particularly in Bonk, there were scenarios where without my going in and being the subject for a couple of these projects, there was no way I could get across to people how strange and awkward that really is to be
right.
A subject in a physiological sex research project. I couldn't interview Masters and Johnson subjects who were actually having sex, you know, intercourse, the whole sexual response cycle is being studied. Those are all anonymous folks. And the way to answer the question was to make myself be the awkward and queasy one. But I try to keep myself out of it for the most part.
A book like Spook, you could have, I guess, gone more into hands-on or whatever on and chose instead to work in the realm of history.
In that case, the qualifying factor was it either based at a university, was it academic? Like the historical stuff, even then, it was the chapter on ectoplasm, the Sorbonne University had sponsored a bunch. Scientific American was involved. Science getting involved in religion and the soul. So that narrowed the focus in that case. I did include the history of spiritualism in that. Scientists got involved. Nobel Prize winning scientists were caught up in that field. So as long as it was academic, if there was somebody doing it in a laboratory setting, applying scientific method, that's what I was fascinated by.
And so in all of your books, there is this edge or rim around the book, which is its relation to, in a way, organized science.
Yeah, especially with Spook, if I didn't have that limiting factor, there's no limit to how far out into the fringes I would have had to travel.
And I would think in something like Bonk as well.
Yeah, very much so. And it, what fascinates me is that intersection. I mean, with sex research, sexual physiology, it is arousal and orgasm are part of their physiology, their anatomy, their biomechanics. But then again, they're intimate and personal and very human. And how do you study them? So that question is what fascinates me.
Let's talk a little about Packing to Mars, Mary Roach. Potty in space. We don't really think about that, or rather odors in space. Was that something you had ever really thought about before you discovered that Apollo astronauts, their capsules stunk?
Yeah, because years ago I interviewed an astronaut. He was a biologist, I think he was an MD, Bill Thornton, and he'd been involved in the study of bone loss. And I was interviewing him about bone loss and some of the work that he'd done. But he told me this story about how they train astronauts. The toilet in space, it's a much smaller opening. It works like a shop vac. It's totally different technology. And he told me the story I would never forget about. There's a training device that has a video camera in the toilet bowl and the closed-circuit TV monitor right next to you, so you're able to get your angle right. You're kind of docking with this thing. The lack of gravity affects everything. You name a body part, something strange is happening. Any technology that works here doesn't work up there. And that's when I first started to think about that, yeah.
Was he the one who originally told you about turds in space?
That came from reading the mission transcript of Gemini. No, it was an Apollo mission. And you can download these PDFs, and they're enormous 400-page files. It's all the communication between mission control and the astronauts. And it's searchable by keywords. So you can. I would sit there, my husband would be watching a ball game, and I'd be typing in, turd, pee, crap. I don't know if I'm allowed to say these words, but
no,
they're
fine.
There in the NASA transcript, so they must be okay. So that was where I came up. I came across this, it was just this wonderful moment where it's this jargon-heavy conversation between the crew, like, oh, in about, you know, in about 25 seconds, we've got a T-16 scheduled to, hey, who is that? It's another turd. You know, just, it's right there in the transcript, and it was really this, you know, they're arguing over whose it is, and because then, back then, there was no toilet. It's a tiny space, severe weight limitations. It's a bag. You're using a bag. It's like backpacking to the nth degree. It's just, you know, compromised hygiene all the way.
And on some of these zero-gravity toilets, if you don't close the toilet at the right time, something will slip out.
There's a term called, and this is the waste management, the waste systems guy, the engineer, was talking about one of the problems, because the way they sterilize it, they expose it to the vacuum of space, it freezes, you know, very solidly frozen. But because it's airflow, it's like a shop vac, you've got this column of air, and these little bits would break off. And zero gravity and airflow, they'd sometimes make their way up the tube. And if you weren't paying attention, first of all, you have fecal popcorning, which is the, you know, because it looks like an air popper, stuff can be sort of flying around with the airflow and the little bits. And if it makes its way out, then it becomes technically known as an escapee.
And, of course, there is a problem with all kinds of liquids, and that includes anything from drinking water to what you excrete.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I found fascinating isn't just the problems of disposal, but even in space, the human bladder works by way of stretch receptors. So the fluid starts to build up on the floor of the bladder. the sides start to stretch, and that's what tells you, oh, time to make your way to the loo. In space, the material's not accumulating on the bottom. It's clinging by surface tension all around, so you don't get that signal until it's much later on, possibly to the point where the urethra would start to be pressed partway shut. And then you have a minor medical situation where you got to get out the self-catheterization kit. And so you don't think about these things, but the organs are we evolved to exist in a place with gravity. We're everything about us is built for walking, for not floating, and in the case of the bladder, having the material on the bottom and not sort of all over.
Well, what about digestion?
Digestion. Here's another story that I love. The human stomach. Again, it's an organ that needs gravity. Okay, here's why. You drink a carbonated beverage, or if you swallow, as you eat, you tend to swallow some air. It's called aerophagia. Normally, this would rise to the top of the stomach. If you drink a carbonated beverage, little bubbles rise to the top. They were able to figure out how to put a carbonated beverage into space. Coke and Pepsi invested a lot of money in that. What they didn't realize, in the stomach, little bubbles don't rise to the top. The top is where the opening is. So when you want to expel that gas because you feel bloated and uncomfortable, you get one of those messy burps with a liquid spray. So nobody thought that through. They thought, we figured it out. Carbonation. Now we can have carbonated beverages in space. Yeah, but no one wants to drink them because you can't really burp very well.
As you proceeded along in your research, more and more of these kind of oddities began surfacing. What, for you, was the strangest one that you discovered?
I found this pretty strange. You grow in zero gravity. The curvature of your spine flattens out, and you are 2 to 3 inches taller. Well, imagine if you're the person who works in fitting suits. You have to factor in a growth spurt for the astronauts. I remember reading one of the memoirs of the cosmonaut saying, on the way back, you're very cramped in your suit. It fit you on the way out, but on the way back, it doesn't fit anymore.
Did you put on a spacesuit?
I did not. In fact, you have to have a pass a certain type of physical even to put one of those on. Because bear in mind, the suits that you see them wearing on a spacewalk are zero gravity suits, so there's no weight to them. They're tremendously heavy. They're like 200 and something pounds. So for you to put that on Earth and try to walk around, you would just fall over and be unable to get back up. They train in a huge tank of water that has a mock-up of pieces of the space station. So they're floating in water. You really can't move around without help wearing this tremendously heavy thing. Once you're in zero gravity, of course, it weighs nothing. I wanted to go in the neutral buoyancy tank and been put on a suit, but the suits are a tremendously expensive piece of equipment, or many pieces of equipment, and it takes two people to put the thing on. NASA doesn't easily allow people to put it. But I've heard that a spacesuit, the line that I recall, one of the suit engineers saying, a spacesuit is not a fun place to be. It's not even a fun place to visit. It's a really uncomfortable, clunky, vision-obscuring, strange-smelling place. It's a little human-shaped room that you're in. It's really very unappealing place to spend your time.
I went out several years ago, passed all the tests for scuba, and I found just putting on the mask and the thing in my mouth was claustrophobic.
Yes. Yeah, my husband felt this. My husband is a good swimmer. I'm a terrible swimmer. I loved it because you're buoyant, because you don't have to worry about staying up, and it's very relaxing. But yeah, I know what you mean. Just having that on your face, the goggle, worrying that it's going to begin leaking, and you're going to have to empty it and all that, yeah.
And then you have that thing on your back, those tanks on your back, or tank. You do have the buoyancy, but the freedom just doesn't feel there. At least it didn't feel there for me. Obviously, for other people, it does. I keep thinking that in a weightless environment and a spacesuit, it's freeing and incredibly claustrophobic, too.
Yeah, I think that you don't really even enjoy. I'm guessing because I haven't been in a spacesuit
right.
In space. I have been in zero gravity, which is wonderful and exhilarating. But to imagine wearing one of those big bulky suits would kind of take all the joy out of it. I think it's probably the whole debate about motorcycle helmets. It's just like the reason I'm on a motorcycle is to feel the wind in my hair. And you put this big bulky thing on my head. I'm not advocating for not wearing helmets, but I think that's probably what's behind the hesitation to wear a motorcycle helmet.
Mary Roach, let's talk a little bit about being in zero gravity. Now, we've all, or most of us, have at one point or another been in a pool, and we've gone underwater, and we've gotten that sense. In Packing for Mars, you talk about, that's cool, it's sort of semi-approximation, but don't even think it's the real thing.
No, I didn't find it to be tremendously similar to that, because with when you float in water, you always feel the resistance. You're moving through a pretty heavy substance. You feel it buoying you. The other thing that's different, in zero gravity, your organs don't weigh anything. And you know, your heart is hanging off your aorta, and your arms are hanging off your shoulders. And there's this weight to yourself that you don't realize until it's gone, and it's this kind of physical euphoria. You're as light as air, literally. I just loved it. If you're one of the unfortunate people who's in the back of the plane with the vomit bag, it's not as much fun. But they give you good drugs, and I had a tremendous... The minute I got down, I thought, how can I do this again? But I probably won't, because you have something like $5,000 to go on one of those flights.
Did your publisher pay for that?
No. If you're a journalist, you should know about this. NASA has it's the Student Flight Opportunities Program. Aerospace students compete to do a zero-gravity research project. My team was doing welding in space, and are the welds weakened by lack of gravity? And you can go along as a journalist. It's outside of near Johnson Space Center, Ellington Field, and you fly out of there on one of those parabolic flights. And if you are a journalist, it's a kind of a fabulous opportunity.
Explain what a parabolic flight is.
Sure. It's a C-9. It's a great big jet, and it's flying kind of a roller coaster up, over, down, back up, over, down. And as the plane goes over and down, you have about 20 seconds of zero gravity where you're floating. And then as it pulls out of the dive and climbs back up, then you're 2 Gs. You weigh twice what you weigh on Earth. And it's a strange sensation. You're lying down on the floor of this plane. All the seats are taken out. And your head weighs twice what it does on Earth. And your neck isn't, my neck wasn't strong enough to lift my head. So you're kind of pinned to the floor in this bizarre manner. And then when you go back over the top and you go back into zero G, these people lying down on the floor of the plane would rise up. It's like the rapture in there. Sun like spooks coming out of the grave, rising up and then floating in the air. It's a very strange scene.
The part where you're at the 2 Gs, you can get that in a number of rides in amusement parks, those big twirly things. Yeah.
Well, you see people with their arms in the air and they're pinned to their seat by extra gravity. Yeah.
But the actual effect of zero gravity, there's no other way to get it, I would think, for more than a second.
You have a couple on an elevator, you know, when it's stopping and you're thrown upward a little bit, you've got like a little fraction of a second on it. If it's a very fast elevator that slows down quickly enough, you're kind of thrown upward. It approximates that, but there's really no, other than the parabolic flight, there's no, or dropping you down an elevator shaft in the moments before you die, you would have the sensation of weightlessness.
Well, what about a person, say, doing a skydive?
Well, in that case, you've got this tremendous air force blowing up against you. So it's a very different sensation. In both cases, yeah, you're technically free falling, but here you're held by this sort of wall of air, or column of air underneath you. I've actually been in a vertical wind tunnel. You know, you shift your body and you zip off in one because you're being pushed all over the place by the wind, whereas in zero gravity, you're just floating like a soap bubble.
And that first time, what was that feeling like, the very first parabola?
There's photographs of me on the NASA Student Flight Opportunities website just grinning like an idiot. Myself and this one other woman who was from NASA headquarters, the education department, she and I, you know, the poor students are having to focus on their experiments. They're down sort of on the ground, and Joyce and I are just kind of like pieces of clothing in a dryer, just laughing. And there's nothing like it. You are really doing the Superman thing. The other thing about zero gravity, your body fluid tends to shift to the upper half of your body, so your wrinkles plump out, your hair is full of body, your breasts don't sag, your organs tend to drift up under your rib cage a little bit, so your waist is smaller. They call it the space beauty treatment.
But it's also kind of bloating effect as well.
Yes, it's also been called puffy face chicken leg syndrome. So, and I've seen enough pictures of astronauts to know that it's not tremendously flattering.
There are a lot of myths in each of your books, in fact. In Spook, a number of myths are debunked concerning the weight of the soul. In Packing for Mars, what myth do you think was dispelled, one that you wouldn't have thought would have been?
Oh, there's a lot of myths dispelled, but some of them are a little more obscure. I'm trying to think of a well-known, because there was the whole Enos the chimp and that whole story. There's a couple delightful hoaxes on the Internet about NASA having spent taxpayer dollars to investigate the best sexual position in zero gravity. And one of them claimed to be a shuttle flight. They even named the number of the flight. Well, this flight exists, and it was an all-male flight, so that was actually it was a particularly amusing faux pas there. There was a second hoax about them having used the neutral buoyancy tank to investigate these. Anyway, both of them are preposterous and they're not true. A couple of journalists actually put these in their nonfiction books about space, that these were things that NASA had investigated. We wanted to know what was a myth that you would have thought was true. Here's one. Okay, there was a myth I always heard. If you throw up in your helmet, when you're out on a spacewalk wearing a whole pressure suit and a pressure helmet, if you get sick, and people do get very sick, especially in the first few days of a mission, and you were to throw up, there was this, I wouldn't say urban, it was a space myth, not an urban myth, that you would inhale the vomit and drown in your own vomit, sort of a la Jimi Hendrix, and that it could be a lethal situation. Well, I talked to suit engineers. They said, no, believe me, we've spent a lot of time thinking about this. There's an air channel at the forehead. You got air flowing down over the face. It would just whoosh it down into the body of the suit, which is gross but not life-threatening. The danger would be, though, that you'd have splatter on your visor. And if you're out, you're doing something on the exterior of a spacecraft, you really need to be able to see where you are and what you're doing. So that could be potentially life-threatening. Your visor splatter could be life-threatening.
As I was reading the book and reading about how NASA was trying to deal with food and number of times one excretes, I kept thinking, my God, they're talking about me and my old dog. And then it turns out that's a little bit closer to reality, because toward the end of the book you admit that a lot of this stuff comes from veterinarians and pet food people.
In the early days, Mercury and Apollo, more Gemini, Apollo, Mercury was such a short one, because there was no toilet. They tried to create food that was quote-unquote low residue, highly processed, no fiber, so they could limit the number of times the poor astronauts had to encounter the bag, the dreaded bag. So, yes, it was the same things you want in pet food. You want to limit the number of times that you got to take the dog out for a walk. Also, you don't want messy stuff to clean up. You want fairly well-formed. So the two concerns that pet food manufacturers face are similar to what the early space food folks, and yes, it was Air Force veterinarians came in at a certain point and said, let's come up with a pelletized formula. Astronaut chow. There was a guy who developed astronaut chow, these little pellets. Bind you right up. Don't have to use the bag.
If mankind will go into space, yeah, this is something that's ongoing.
There was an amazing quote in 1964. It was the Conference on Space Nutrition and Related Waste Concerns. And one of the lines was, for the short missions of Mercury and Gemini, the solution has been a constipated astronaut. And that wasn't a joke. It was true. And I remember the longest mission, Gemini mission, was 2 weeks. It was the first time anybody got on for 2 weeks, and it was Lovell and Borman. Borman was determined to make it the whole 2 weeks without using the bag. He got to day 9. He had to use it. And Jim Lovell's going, come on, Frank, only 5 more days.
In Spook, you wound up talking to a lot of very strange people, and one would think that when you're speaking with scientists in the mainstream, and there's nothing more mainstream than space and space exploration, I mean, you have to be mainstream to be involved in it. Were they saner or just as crazy in a different way?
They were saner. Of course, there were astronauts who became very affected by their experience. They became very spiritual. It was Mitchell and Scott Carpenter, too, was very sort of moved by the whole experience of seeing Earth from space. But in terms of their sense of humor, the space folks were much funnier than the soul people, the New Age, the people who are investigating the persistence of personality after death, is how they've termed it at University of Virginia. These people are so, I guess because they're constantly getting criticized and in fearing that they'll lose their funding, so they try to speak in very sort of technical terms, and they're very, very somber people, which I didn't really expect. The sex folks, very good senses of humor. The space people are pretty funny, particularly the engineers who work in the waste control departments, and the astronauts too. Despite all the stress they're under, they're pretty funny.
How many astronauts did you wind up interviewing total?
Probably about 20 astronauts, cosmonauts, yeah.
And did they seem to have certain traits in common?
They are all very high-achieving, very determined people. You don't get into space by being a slacker. But they're not humorless, and they're not really controlling. Because the other thing about the space program now, as opposed to in the early days of the right stuff, you got 5 or 6 people in a small space. So they are selected by their ability to be flexible, sense of humor, fairness. These are actual recommended astronaut attributes. Ability to form stable and quality interpersonal relationships. They're really good people, in addition to people who got good grades, who did all their homework. They're folks who get along with people. They're people that you like right away. They're very charismatic.
Mary Roach, in your refrigerator, you had reconstituted pee. And you drank it?
The last chapter has to do with a Mars mission. The book is not about Mars, even though it's in the title. It's not a Mars-specific book. And that is an exercise in extreme recycling. All of the water for 5 people for 3 years is a tremendous amount of weight. So you would be doing recycling. You would be drinking your urine and your sweat. On the International Space Station, they have a rig for doing that right now. And I thought, well, I'm going to go interview and talk to this guy who was involved in that design of that. And he's down at NASA Ames, and I'm not far away. I thought, well, we'll go to the cafeteria and let's, as our beverage, we'll drink a glass of our own purified urine. And so I went through the process. It was actually kind of educational. I wasn't using the system they use up there. I was using a very simple method, activated charcoal, which is an amazing substance, all these little nooks and crannies that entrap all the impurities. And then to get the salt out, a very simple, it's called osmotic pressure, kind of swapping sweet for salty. And it takes a few hours. And you know, if you've had one of these little kits on a lifeboat, you could happily drink your urine. It tastes very sweet, kind of tastes like something you'd feed hummingbirds. It is largely a psychological hurdle. It's not distasteful in any way. And the NASA stuff, I've heard they've had journalists come in and they can't tell the difference between tap water and treated urine. This guy who I was speaking to was saying that then down in Orange County, that's going on now. They add a few steps in to separate toilet from tap and make people feel more comfortable. But he said they don't really need to do that. They're basically doing toilet to tap right now, and they are very, very good at what they do. And people have this sense that, oh, a mountain stream, that's the pure water. It's like, well, he said, have you seen the livestock out there? So it was an interesting exercise, particularly in thinking into the future and what we may face with water shortages.
Well, there's also discussion, and of course the astronauts put a stop to it as soon as possible, which is reconstituted hard excretion.
Oh, yeah. Someone brought that up at that old 1964 conference. The possibility of reuse must be considered. And someone I interviewed said he was at a workshop where the astronauts are like, we are not eating burgers on the way back. One thing I love about, okay, for a Mars mission, this, again, with the extreme recycling and using everything, hydrocarbons are very good at shielding radiation. The metal spacecraft is not, tends to break the cosmic rays down into more dangerous pieces. So you would save the waste matter and line the living module with it for the return. So on the way to Mars, you're flying in a can of food, and on the way home, you're flying in a can of feces.
Well, let's suppose for a second, Mary Roach, that they actually did reconstitute feces, and it was presented to you. Would you have eaten it?
Mine or someone else's?
I'm not saying.
That was the big thing with the urine guy. I said, hey, you want a sip? He goes, no. You only do your own. I was like, I don't have any. I'm fine. I'm clean. He's like, no, thanks. That was the real test, is to drink somebody or eat someone else's. But, you know, if they process it enough, it's all carbon-based. I mean, I for the sake of the chapter, I'm sure I would have tried it. I would have tried it for sure. I mean, it would certainly have been processed to the point where you, and hopefully they would have, you know, made it into some interesting, you know how it is with meat. You want to make it look not like an animal. You want to disguise the fact that it's a piece of an animal. The same thing, I think, if they made it, you know, made it look like a little pettifor or a truffle or something, and put some frosting on it or something, I think I could have handled it.
Let's talk the politics of it. It is called Packing for Mars. You know, a lot of people talk about problems on Earth. Obviously, we can't solve problems by throwing money at them. On the other hand, we've got a failing infrastructure, and an argument could be made that maybe money should be spent on rebuilding our highways while we have them rather than sending someone to Mars.
Absolutely. And if you could guarantee that the money that would be spent on Mars would be spent on roads and education and medical research, I would say for sure spend it here, but it never seems to work that way. You cut back on the roads and the education, and then you just cut back on the space exploration as well. But yes, if that money taken were used for these things, I would absolutely agree with you.
Some of the items that came about because of space exploration, I mean, I remember in college learning that one of the greatest technological advances in a weird way was war, because it's during war that you get all these jumps that can later be used in peacetime. But in this case, we've got, in terms of peace, we've got a lot of items. Trash compactors?
There are unique challenges to space. So it tends to be things that are automated, miniaturized, cordless, very lightweight, very strong, fireproof, that kind of technology. Also things, high-speed wireless data transfer. These are technologies that, but you're right, the military. I mean, just, I remember once finding out about all of the recreational stuff, the American outside or outdoors pursuits, the tents, the jeeps, the rafts, all of this stuff grew out of the military needing to be in remote places and doing things. So, yeah, technology that comes out of the military, but of course at a huge price that I don't support. So the space side of it is a little more palatable for me, and it would be for a Mars mission, you know, a lot of sort of extreme sustainability types of technology would come out of it.
Trash compactors, bulletproof vests.
Kevlar, yeah, bulletproof vests. Strong, because it's a strong, flexible fabric. Sports bras.
Yeah, I got
Thank
that.
Thank God for sports bras. Where would we be? Not Tang, by the way. There's an excellent Tang story about Tang they used in the in-suit drink bag when they were on the moon. Kind of like a camel pack. You know, the thing that when you're hiking, you have the little, mm-hmm. you press on the mouthpiece and it comes out. Well, they had Tang in those. And poor Charlie Duke, the man's on the moon for the first time, it's leaking. So he's got Tang all over coming down. He's got this great quote where there's these two craters, Wreck and Trap. And he says, yeah, I can see Wreck and Trap and orange juice. His visor's just totally covered with Tang. It's those human moments.
What did you leave out of the book?
All the boring stuff. What did I leave out? I left out, okay, I should have had a chapter about, specifically about radiation, because that is a big concern in space. I do make reference to it, but I didn't go into tremendous detail about it because it's a little technical. On second thought, I would include more about that. I recently learned, I got an email from somebody that I met in STIF who came up with a composting method for if you die, you'd freeze the body and then you would do a composting technique. Well, they wrote to me and said they worked with NASA on a proposal for a technology that on a Mars mission, if somebody died, you would freeze the body. So it was a whole discussion of what do you do if an astronaut dies on a long mission, particularly on a Mars mission. That I wish I could have included. I didn't know about it, and I'd love to have included that because, of course, my stiff readers would have loved that. We do have a cadaver in the book, though. There was a cadaver test.
There's nothing specifically about Mars either.
Well, no, it's not. It's a book about living for long periods of time. So we have Mars. We're using Mars just to sort of stand in for, you know, when people think of being in space a long time, they think of a Mars mission. So,
when you reflect back on some of the science fiction films you've seen, do any of them, in terms of the research, seem more or less plausible to you?
Well, 2001 was way ahead of its time. Remember when Keir DeLay is jogging in that big donut-shaped wheel? That's to create artificial gravity. It's spinning, basically spinning people against the floor to create Earth gravity. And so you don't have the bone loss. You would do exercise in that spinning module. For a Mars mission, that would be the best alternative. As a big moving part, it's the engineering is difficult and it's costly, but that would certainly be the best way to combat. There's just an amazing amount of bone and muscle loss on a long mission.
What was the most bizarre experiment you ran across?
The most bizarre experiment, I think the most bizarre paper I came across was there was somebody who advocated, and this is back when we were just heading to the moon, and the thinking was as soon as we finish that, we'll be heading right on to Mars. So there was this conference, and people were kind of thinking outside the box, and this one nutritionist, they were contemplating, well, it's a lot of weight to launch, or how are we going to get all that food up there? And this guy said, well, if NASA could find suitably obese astronauts, if you had 50 pounds of excess weight, that's 184,000 calories of reserves, and then that he could live off those for 90 days. So this guy had calculated, he was advocating sending an obese astronaut and then starving him. The thinking outside the box that goes on for figuring out how would we get people, tremendous number of people, long duration mission, how would that work? Somebody else was saying that you could make the clothing out of edible keratin fibers, and when you're finished wearing the clothes, you would eat the clothes. So those were, I think, the most, I thought, wow, someone actually thought that thought.
And before we leave, there's also sex in space, the idea that perhaps people will hook up, and it would be best if people were bisexual because they could hook up with everybody.
There's a gentleman at NASA Ames who has done work on looking at What's the most effective or efficient combination, all male, all female, or mixed gender? And we got into a conversation of, well, who would you send to Mars? Do you send married couples? Well, there goes that marriage. We were looking at Antarctica. What happens in Antarctica is that's sort of an analogous situation. You're confined, you're limited, small group. And he said what happens is people tend to link up for the duration of their stay, and then it's over. It's sort of a coping strategy, and it tends to work fairly well. And so he thought that it would be people who, you know, we're okay with sort of a temporary situation, not necessarily with strong feelings about monogamy, maybe a little mix and match, as he put it. And maybe, yeah, it's like a combination of gay and straight. I hope he still has his job.
Mary Roach, what's the footnote for the next one?
I'm keeping it under my hat for now, but I think that there is, I'll just tell you, there is a footnote in there. There's a clue.
In your research on your new book, doesn't that open up sometimes, like you said, the idea of finding stuff that should have been in Bonk or Stiff or Spook or Packing for Mars?
I'm always driving myself crazy by stumbling onto something in the research for one book that I would have killed to have in the last book. And often when I go to a book talk, someone will raise their hand and say, oh, I just finished reading Bonk. You should have talked to, you know, my uncle worked for Kinsey or something like that, where were you 2 years ago? You know, so that happens all the time. It drives me crazy.
And finally, I guess, do you see yourself writing these kinds of books from now on? Do you ever think about, well, maybe I'll move into fiction or try something else?
No, I know I can't do anything else. I have no imagination. Fiction, people who write fiction amaze me. You know, I'm the kind of person, I gather a pile of sticks and I build the best thing I can with the pile of sticks. And if I had to make up my sticks, I'd be lost. I couldn't do fiction, no.
Well, one thing I've noticed in all of your books is these little footnotes and asides. And I assume if some of them are jokes, but I never know whether it is or not. Because
well, they're all real.
Every single
thing.
They're
all real. Nothing's made up.
Absolutely nothing.
Absolutely nothing is made up. No.
Do you just, like, keep a separate file of stuff that you might wind up using but you never know?
As I come across stuff, I either put it in there's a folder that says put somewhere. It's a manila folder, and on the tab it says put somewhere because it's good stuff. It's great stuff. I don't know where it will fit, and it may not fit anywhere, but I'll make it fit by putting it in a footnote.
And in terms of research, what percentage is online and what percentage is actually getting out into the field and how much is books?
Very, very few books, as in other authors' books, because they're often errors. I tend to use journal articles, tend to be pretty obscure journal articles, lots of interviews. The Internet is very, very useful in helping me track down the people that I'm going to talk to and the articles and books that I want, but I don't tend to use the Internet itself much, except for kind of the goofier. Sometimes I'll come across something that, like that footnote about the Bigelow Space Corporation, and never mind. You know, Wikipedia is a good place to start, but I don't use facts in there without checking them elsewhere.
There's one long segment where you track down a story down to two different books. And then eventually you have to stop because the authors are dead. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, it was about the chimpanzee Enos. There was a rumor about his nickname and how that came about. And I had been interviewing his trainer, and he said, well, where did you hear that? The nickname is Enos the Penis. And there's this, in several books, they say that this chimp had this proclivity to fondling himself. And I asked the trainer, and he said, well, where did you hear that? He said, Enos didn't do that. We called him Enos the Penis because he was a son of a gun. He was a dick. That's why we called him that. I said, really? He didn't touch himself? He said, Mary, all chimps do that. But no, I went, really? And I was determined to figure out who started that rumor. So I traced it back through one book, then an article online, and then two more books before that. And I think I did finally find the source of it, but it was then I just got caught up and like became a personal quest to figure out where the heck did that come from.
And it finally came down to a source that you couldn't get to.
Right. He had passed on, yeah.
Finally, these are nonfiction. However, have you had any interest from Hollywood?
Yeah, we have. There's people who express interest in doing like a Discovery TV type of thing. And also there have been a number of folks who said, we'd love to do a scripted program, maybe about you. But as it turns out, because writers are passive, you know, nothing happens in our lives. We're writing about other people, not mine. to be writing about other people. Other people are having interesting lives that we then write about, but our own lives are often very solitary and, in my case, fairly mundane. So you don't have that, with the exception of course, the Sex and the City woman, who seemed to have a fascinating and very entertaining social life. It doesn't tend to work out. The writer gets hold of it and goes, just has to completely make it up, and so far nobody's been able to figure out a way. I think it would be like Adaptation, that Susan Orlean, you know, the book about the movie about Susan Orlean's book. It would be an unusual challenge, I think, to take one of my books and make a film.
You've been listening to an interview with Mary Roach, whose latest book is Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.